Good morning, everyone. My name is Jennifer L. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is 5/28/06, May 28th, 2006. I was actually picking up my Desire chip on Memorial Day, the day before Memorial Day, on Memorial Day weekend. So I have another sobriety date on Memorial Day. So I have this thing about drinking on Memorial Day. So, and it's the 4th of July, and I want to say happy 4th of July to everyone. I am from Lafayette, Louisiana. Is anybody here from that area? Yes. All right, a few people. That's nice. Thank you, Cole, for moderating, and thank you for asking me to speak. Eva, if you're out there. I was born legally blind, just to get into a little story about myself. I was the third child of six children. I was the only one, and still am the only one, with a visual or any kind of disability in my family. From a very early age, I was taught the skills and all that's needed to be independent as a blind member of society, such as traveling with a cane, reading Braille. I was able to see peripherally as a young child, but I was still taught large print because I was able to see, but I was still taught Braille because there was always that indication that I may lose my vision at some point. So there was always that that threat or that knowledge, especially in the mind of my mom, my dad, and my teacher, and the doctors that looked at my eyes as a child. I was diagnosed actually 6 months as legally blind, and at the age of 3, I was diagnosed as deaf in my left ear. And my right ear, I've always been able to hear normally. This is all a result of a birth defect, which is unknown to what the cause may be. But the fact is that I've lived my whole life as a person who's visually impaired. And I look at it as a person who's visually impaired because, first and foremost, I'm a human being. And along with that, I'm also an alcoholic, so I want to identify that before we go any further. I'm an alcoholic not because I'm blind, not because of my hearing impairment, but because of the same thing everyone else deals with, that disease of the mind and of perception that tells me that somehow, some way, I'm different from everybody else. And yes, in the way I drink, I'm different from those who drink normally. But in the fact that I think differently and perceive things differently, and as soon as I drink alcohol in any form and take it into my body, ingest it, or any other way, something happens to where I don't react like normal people. And I started drinking at the age of 11 because of this feeling different, because of this disease of perception and of the mind. And from there, it progressed. For several years in high school, I did not drink. But as soon as college came around, I started to drink and started to party with friends. And it proceeded from there. And I came into Alcoholics Anonymous in 2002. And from there, I proceeded to relapse every year until I finally picked up my last Desire chip in 2006. I ended up in institutions, reacted to people in a way that could have gotten me put in jail, but I wasn't caught, and proceeded to go down the road that we all go down, to where when I picked up my last Desire chip, I hit a spiritual and emotional bottom. And from there, I proceeded to realize that I needed to do something different, that even though I felt different inside, that I'm not different from my fellows, that I'm not so much different in the way I think and perceive life from other alcoholics. And over time, I proceeded to find my home here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And today, I see Alcoholics Anonymous as home. At about 6 years of sobriety, I underwent a spiritual awakening. And during that spiritual awakening, I started to see a greater importance of the three legacies in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the major thing that came out of that was service. When I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was told many times I wanted to get involved in service, and I was told many times by well-meaning people that I didn't need to do that, that I just needed to sit and let everybody take care of me. But as an alcoholic, like everyone else, I realized that service and giving back what's been given to me is the most important gift I have in this program. And so I proceeded at 6 years of sobriety to find out how I could be of service. I developed more of a life of prayer and meditation, which continues to grow today. I developed more in the 10th step, where taking the daily inventory. And through prayer and meditation, I realized that something needs to be done with members in our district with special needs. I'm a member of Area 27, Louisiana, and also a member of District 13C, which is where my home group is located. And I proceeded to go to our district meetings, and from there, I realized that there was interest in starting a special needs committee, but there wasn't anyone chairing that committee as of that time. So I went to the next service committee meeting and was elected to chair the first special needs committee in our district. And it was an honor for me, and still is an honor, that I've served as the chair of the special needs committee, because it was a teaching tool for me. And so, as soon as I got involved, I started to contact two organizations in our town. One serves the deaf and blind, and one serves, both serve the deaf and blind. One more serves more of the blind community. And I have many friends in the blind community. I've always had many friends in that community, and many of them have made it to these rooms, and many have not. And so I proceeded to contact those organizations and bring Braille literature, large print literature, and just to assess what their needs were. And at one such organization for the blind, I was actually asked to speak, and later became president of that organization, but that's neither here nor there. That's outside. But still, it's been a good experience reaching out to my fellow human beings who are blind, and also to the future members of Alcoholics Anonymous, to bring that message that needs to be, that's truly needed. And I saw that there was a huge need for those who are deaf in our community. And I've proceeded to contact another member of a special needs committee who happens to be visually impaired in another state, and they were able to send me information on how Alcoholics Anonymous is, the message of Alcoholics Anonymous is being brought to those who are deaf and hearing impaired. And so far, the main groups we've been able to help with the special needs committee are those who are blind, those who need access to meetings but who aren't able to make those meetings because they're homebound, those who are in wheelchairs or mobility impaired, and also those who are not able to always attend meetings because they have children. And that is a special need in our area that we've seen a huge need for and have addressed that need. Before I rotated out of the position of special needs chair, I was able to get a committee together and help put on a workshop. And through that workshop, we had six panels. It was a half-day workshop that we gave. There was 25 members of Alcoholics Anonymous who attended, and we had six panels addressing the different needs in our area, such as veterans, those in treatment with special needs, those in corrections facilities with special needs, veterans, and mothers of young children. We were able to address those needs. We had different members in the district and other, actually a neighboring district speak to those needs. And as an alcoholic, it's very important. It's always been very important that I'm not treated any differently. Although that's not always easy because being selfish and self-centered, I know for me, I tend to have that proclivity to want special help and special attention. But what's most important is that I realize that first and foremost, I'm an alcoholic. And after that, I'm a member who's blind. Because first of all, we're all one in this fellowship. We're all alcoholics and we all have that tendency to perceive the world around us differently. And then when we take that drink, the craving sets in for more alcohol and to change the way we feel. I know for me, as soon as I take alcohol, it changes the way I feel and I want to continue that. But through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've found the tools necessary to change those things inside me that I'm not able to change on my own. And those tools are, for me today, the steps, service, and unity of the fellowship. And when I think of unity of the fellowship, I think of coming to this convention, for example, and standing in line for registration or standing in line for the MARTA shuttle and just knowing that we're all the same. We're all alcoholics registering or all alcoholics getting on that transit system. And there's no special alcoholic. They're just alcoholics who need assistance accessing the meetings and accessing these rooms. And for someone who's blind, it's not so much communication that's a need, but reading the material that's put out by the General Service, such as the book Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12 Steps and 12 Traditions. And when I went into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and raised my hand and said, I'm Jennifer, I'm an alcoholic. After the meeting, another lady came up to me and said, we have a big book in Braille. And even at our intergroup central office, there continues to be literature and books in Braille for those who need that. And the importance for me, in my opinion, is that every need is accessed. And every need is met for all those who want recovery, all those who can get it and who are willing to get it and who are able to. And I'll enjoy seeing or just hearing that there are those who sign for the deaf and hard of hearing. There are needs being accessed here. The transportation to and from the hotels to the World Congress Center. It's just amazing how Alcoholics Anonymous comes together, how, as they say in the big book, erstwhile erratic alcoholics are just people who are selfish and self-centered, like I know I am, who could come together and help make Alcoholics Anonymous in this recovery program and the fellowship and even the service of others in this program accessible. I do sponsor women. And what has been very meaningful for me about sponsoring women is knowing and experiencing the steps through hearing them work the steps, through hearing their voice change, through hearing their spirit develop, through hearing what goes on with these women as they work through the steps and as they have that spiritual awakening and that change. And I may not be able to see that light come on in their eyes, but I know there's a light there that wasn't there before. And sponsoring, being able to sponsor and be of service in Alcoholics Anonymous has been a true gift for me. and to know that I can be of service and sponsor other women. And I want to share one thing, that one question I've been asked is, how do you write a fourth step? Because it says in the big book, we put pen to paper and we set things down in black and white. And of course, it wouldn't do me any good to write my resentment inventory with pen and paper and be able to read that to my sponsor. I mean, it's just kind of like obvious. And I've had people ask me, well, can you write in Braille? Can you write the steps down in Braille? Or can you write it on the computer? And, of course, that's mainly how I've written my steps, my inventories throughout the years. And now with the advances in technology, I'm able to text. And I love texting. And I love emailing. And I love using the voice recorders, the dictation with my iPhone. And one thing that I do is that I do text my sponsor my inventories, but I make sure that I call her after so that we can discuss it. And sometimes I do have a Braille machine called the Braille Note, which is a note-taking device that it's an electronic note-taking device. And what I do with that is I write in Braille, and I can read it. I can read my inventories to my sponsor in that way. So with the advances in technology, there are many more ways that those who are blind or who have other impairments can access the program by working the steps, by writing inventories. And there's so many spiritual books out there, including the big book. The big book is in Braille and large print and recorded. But along with that, there are many spiritual books that are recorded and in Braille. So that I can seek to know God more and seek to understand my God is of my understanding or misunderstanding, however you want to put it, because I don't understand God. I think I do, but I really don't. I'm always learning. Even here at this conference, I've been learning. So throughout the years, even though I've turn to alcohol as a solution, I've been able to go to school, go to college, get training in independent living several times, get training in mobility by using a cane. I've chosen to use a cane instead of a guide dog, and there are several modes of transportation for those of us who are blind. And I've been able to live independently without needing alcohol as a solution today. And Alcoholics Anonymous has afforded me that freedom and that independence, because without it, I would be very dependent on everyone. I would be a child. But through the steps, through this program, through this wonderful fellowship, I'm able to live independently. I'm able to ask for help when I need it, and I continue to learn and grow in these areas. And it's a joy to do this. And with that, I want to thank you all for listening.
Hi, everyone. Cole DiMatteo, alcoholic. Thank you so much. That was, wow. I serve Area 44 as the Special Needs Remote Communities Chair. And I should give it a little plug, since that's what this is. Special needs is for anyone who, when there's an obstacle that they can't get to a meeting, or even if they can't get the entire experience from a meeting. Our next speaker is going to explain what I mean by that. And then we have the remote communities, where it's geography, language, or culture, okay? And a lot of times with that, we have to bring a Polish community. I have a Filipino community. So I bring them the literature. It's almost like a PI thing, you know, and go over there and give them literature, because we're noticing they're not being represented as a whole in AA, and we'd like to see that happen. We need people in service, as most of you know, okay? I mean, when I took special needs, remote communities, they told me that I'm a committee of one. All right. I explained to them that I have my own committee I travel with, so you know we'll even get some minority opinions in there. But you know, any time, and Jennifer put it out there, you know, it was so easy for someone to sit back and let others take care of them. And I think that's such a strong message that she just shared with us. No, I don't need anybody taking care of me. As a matter of fact, there's someone who needs me to help them, and that's just amazing to me. Can we just quickly, before I bring Jesse up, can we give a hand to the interpreters over there, please? Because that is just amazing. So, and you find yourself watching them, right? Even though you can hear it perfectly, I can't help but watch because it's just a great thing that they do. And again, I was enlightened. I met Jesse just a few minutes before this started, and he enlightened me on something. I'm not going to give it all away, but that's our next speaker. It's Jesse.
Hi, my name is Jesse, and I'm an alcoholic. What an honor it is to be here. It's an honor to be here. My sobriety date is March 2nd, 2012. My home group is Dry Dock. I live in Bellingham, Washington. That's the Great Northwest. District 11, Area 72. Anyhow, it sure is an honor to be here for the 80th year of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is my first international, and it's really been an exciting thing for me. You know, I am an alcoholic. I'm going to share a little bit about what it used to be like and what happened, and what's going on with me today. What you know, I started as a young child, you know, around alcohol and violence, a lot of fear. I remember as a really young child, you know. Me and my little sister trying to hide when, you know, my father would come home and violence would happen, and it was ugly and whatnot. And, you know, I grew up around that, and what I can share is money don't buy freedom. I always thought it did, and it never did. I grew up with all the toys, you know, the dirt bikes and all them kinds of things, and as I grew up, I kind of like lived on the edge. There was, you know, I was in my preteens, you know, and I kind of experienced, you know, sipping on the beer and stuff of the sort. And you know, I grew up. My mother was the oldest, and you know, my youngest uncle is only a year older than me. So you know, I always wanted to be like the grown-ups, you know. Yeah, I sure did. I wanted to be like the grown-ups. And so anyhow, I was about 12 years old, and if I worked like a man, I got to drink like a man with the grown-ups. And I started doing that between 6th and 7th grade. And when I started doing that, you know, what it was is I wanted to fit in with all the people I got to work with and stuff. And you know, because I didn't want to be with the kids in science and all that. You know, I wanted to be out there having fun, or so I thought. I was 18 years old, and I kind of like graduated up drinking and doing other stuff. And what happened was, is like I shared, I grew up living on the edge. The weekend of the 4th of July, 1984, and I was drinking, and we had M80s and stuff, and we're on three-wheelers, tearing up the city and the town. And what happened was, is a car pulled out on me. And I'm driving on the road, right? So I'm blaming the car. And what happened was is I hit a car on a three-wheeler, and I flew through the intersection, and I was in a coma. What happened with that is I guess it was 7 days later. I don't know. They say 7 days later, and I came to, and I had all these tubes and all these things going through me, and I didn't know what was happening. And you know, my aunt, she coming running in and out. Oh no, he's awake! He's awake! And whatnot. And so anyhow, I started pulling things out of me. I remember, and she just kind of like held me there, and so the next I remember was, you know, they like moved me from there to, there was nothing they could really do in the hospital, so they took me home, and, you know, I stayed in the living room and being taken care of by my mother and stuff of the sort, and I was like not supposed to drink no more. I wasn't supposed to drink no more, but, you know, a little while later, you know, I drank again. And there was, you know, the violence and all that kind of stuff around me still. And got to the point to where my mother left my father. And I was with my father, you know, and he put a .30-06 hollow point under his chin. And he, you know, he pulled the trigger. And so, about that time, I like, they moved me into a psychiatric hospital. We call it Western State there in Washington State. And, they moved me in there for a while, and, they, had me on a lot of Thorazine, medications trying to, calm me down, I guess, whatever, and, what they ended up doing is eventually they weaned me off of that and they let me back out supposedly into society, and I didn't fit. I was out of control. And I couldn't live in there. I couldn't live out here. I couldn't stand being in my skin. No, I really don't know who understands what insanity is between my ears. But what I understand is that I am learning. Little by slow. I'm chipping away at this. You know, I realize that if I take a drink, the drink will take a drink. And I understand if I take the first drink and the drink then takes that drink, I'm unpredictable. We just don't know. I've lost the ability to understand that. So anyhow, you know, I've been with a lot of doctors and psychiatrists and other forms of mental health. I've been through the long terms, the short terms. And what happened was is I went in and I told my doctor the truth. And when I looked my doctor in the eyes and showing her the chronic depression and the fear and out of controlness. And, you know, the fear of being in public, so crazy, so hard for me for so long. And she come up with, she thought about it, she said about 3 years ago before this, before I talked to her about this, and she looked me in the eyes, and she, you know, she asked me a question. She said, "Do you like animals?" "Yes." "Do you like dogs?" "Yes." "Would you like one on your side at all times?" I didn't understand. I didn't comprehend what she meant by that. And so we did talk about this stuff for a little while. And what happened was she explained to me that with me, in my own mind, by myself, I'm in a dangerous place. And so, So what happened was she gave me a prescription. And a little while later, you know, I ended up back in West Seattle Psychiatric Hospital. And I was in there for 2 weeks. And what they did is they gave me a bus ride back to Bellingham, Washington. And I was suggested that we get into the computer, right, Rainey? And we search to find me, a higher power. Find me something that can be with me at all times. That can love me. That can give me support. That can kiss and hug. And what happened was, is we looked for about 4 months, and see, we did this at least an hour a day, 5 days a week, and we were putting out an honest effort. Well, it was about 4 months into that, I got mad. I got really angry. I'm exaggerating. I tell people I kicked a hole in the wall and I went up to the Shell station. I got a little nickel, and what that is a free paper. And what it was, I got a phone number for puppy shepherds, German shepherds, and I made a phone call talked to the gal, and I let her know, and I told her about what my doctor suggested, and when I shared with her, she said, "How could I give something I love to something like that?" Because I did. I told her the truth. I told her what I was telling my doctor, and then what my doctor shared with me, and the thing is, she didn't hang up on me. We stayed communicating. And she said, "I'm going to take the risk." You know, so 5 years and 7 months ago, she took the risk. You know, I went and I got to go meet Rainey and her two little brothers. And somehow, some way, Rainey looked at me and never took her eyes off of me for more than an hour. And I made a choice. When I made that choice, I took her by the lead. What I have today is I have something to be responsible for. And for me to have some kind of responsibility, you see, I have a commitment. I am loved and I give my love to her. What we do is we share this together. I don't know what kind of time I got, you know. See, if I get into my drunkalog, it can get really nasty and ugly. And some of that is very uncomfortable for me. But the thing is, if anything I share helps you, that's great. That is really great. And if it's something that pops in with you in your, you know, as what I've shared, you could take out there and help somebody else, please do. I'm not the only one that needs some support. You know, I've not found a human power that has relieved me of my alcoholism. You know, I am dyslexic. When you think of G-O-D, I think of G-O-D or D-O-G. And, you know, I'm not the creator, you know, so when people try to say, you know, I know God, well, I don't. I have no idea. I have no idea. What I do understand is we and us together are doing for me what I cannot do alone. I truly do believe it's all about team. You know, and you know, when we're all focusing into recovery, when we're focusing to positive things happen. You know, what I can share with you too, you know, is that when I did bad, I felt bad. Okay? When I did evil, I felt evil. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous, Rainey, the powers greater than me, you know, they say, "Hey, Jesse, let's learn this. Let's do good and feel good." You know, so if I'm given positive vibes out, usually positive ones are coming back. You know, and I was supposed to learn a lot of this stuff in grammar school, like if you want a smile, give a smile. You know, you want a hug, give a hug. You know, if I want somebody to be polite to me, I probably should be polite to them. You know, the chances are pretty or better if I'm that way. And, you know, the thing is I'm listening and I get to hear about people, you know, well, we'll take care of you. We'll take care of you. You know, reality is I got to make the last decision. I'm going to have to take that last step, you know, and whatnot. And, you know, I'm just one of the fortunate few that, are here. You know, I'm glad you're all here. And, you know, I'm just amazed that, you know, where I'm at with 3 years sober is beyond my wildest dreams. The reason that is because I didn't know I had any hope for even a day. Even a day without a drink and wanting to be in my own skin. And, when I was guided through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, see, because, you know, my sponsor looked at me and he said, you know, I stood up in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and said, man, I need your help tonight. Don't somebody keep coming back. You know, and, the thing that happened was, after the last prayer, he came up and he said, how can I help you? You know, and, what he did, he got me into love and service. The first 5 minutes of our conversation, are you washing the cups or are you drying the cups, Jesse? You know what? That next morning, he had me doing homework. You know, and he shared with me, Jesse, did you take any days off getting drunk? Nope, sure didn't. We're not going to take no days off here growing in our recovery. You know, and you're going to want to be in your skin pretty soon. So here we are, 3 years sober, and I like being with me, and I'm glad to be with you guys, and I thank you very much. Come on, guys.
Thank you so much, Jesse. That was wonderful. Now, our last speaker here is Mac, and I'm under the impression it's not his first convention. I might be wrong. I've jumped to conclusions before. But, Mac, you want to get up and say something?
My name is Mac McCoy, and I'm an alcoholic. Please help me by saying the surrender prayer. God, grant me a serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous at 26 years old, and I didn't know that I didn't know. Everything that they said this morning, I was walking in their shoes. I went to special education. They didn't know why I couldn't read. They didn't know why I couldn't function like a normal person. I always, always felt different. And then, at the age of 13, I stole a double of Corby's. And my whole world changed. I was sentenced to go to special education because back in the 70s, they didn't, back in the 50s, they didn't know. They didn't know anything about dyslexia. They didn't know anything about anything, really. I was not doing what I was supposed to do. And so they kept pushing me up in grade school. And then they come up with this idea that they were going to isolate all of us and put us in one little building and forget about us until we were age 16. So I started to go to special. When I was 13, I was in the sixth grade, and I had been pushed up to the sixth grade. I had my best grade was my best class was geography. Lots of pictures and no words. And I loved to dream about being fancy places and going. I've always dreamt about meeting the Queen and the Pope. I even got to Europe, but never got to see the Pope or the Queen. I I was working in a large factory, and an angel came into my life. He told my boss that I was alcoholic and that he would take me to AA and there would be no more problems. And my boss said he was going to fire me if I didn't. And I was going to drinking every day. And I told him, I said, I can't be an alcoholic. I'm only 24 years old. My dad was alcoholic. I'm fourth generation alcoholic. I can't be an alcoholic. I have a house. I have children. I have this. I have that. I have this. I have all the things that my dad didn't have or didn't provide for us. Because he was alcoholic. I didn't know he was alcoholic. I had a lot of resentments against my dad. I didn't realize that he had black eyes. He didn't mean to do the things that he had done to us. Physically, mentally. My mother divorced my dad and married another alcoholic. And the chapter started all over again. And then I took a drink. And then I started the chapter with my family. But Bill Shepherd, he was a member of AA. He was 4 years sober. I thought he had centuries. And he was desperate for a pigeon. And so my name became not Mac, but get in the car. And my wife would say to Bill, he's drinking. Never mind, Wilma. He'll get in the car. And he took me to meetings drinking. I changed my sobriety date so many times that my home secretary had a book. And he said when I first went into my first meeting, I was drinking. I know it. I was reeking of booze because I drank every day. He had me join the group. And he changed my sobriety date so many times. So many times. He said, I won't tell anybody if you drink, but you have to tell me. And I would drink a drink, and I would tell him. For some reason, honest, I got honest about my drinking. To make a long story short, I messed up his bookkeeping because he would erase it each time that I drank. And on the last day, on December the 23rd, of 1970, 44 years ago, I took my last drink. And the journey has been absolutely fantastic because I have so many angels in my life. You know, I got talking books. I got angels. I had a Polish immigrant read the driver's manual on tape so that I could get my driver's license because I wouldn't have had a driver's license if it wasn't for AA. I was 6 months sober and the big book had not been recorded on tape. And a Polish immigrant in a living room, and he had a sleeping room, read the big book, 17 90-minute tapes. And by the way, he did mark down the day. He did mark down the page. He said, this page 25, and then he would read it. He gave it to me in a brown paper bag at a meeting and said that if I was going to be successful in Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have to know what's in this book. This book. And now I did because he read it to me. They found out that I had dyslexia. I went to the VA. I said, I had spent 5 years in the military. Can you believe I spent 5 years in the military and I couldn't read? But I'm a good show and tell man. You show me, I can do it. But don't give me a book. I went to the VA and they diagnosed me dyslexic. And then I got talking books, and I got to go to college. I got a high school diploma. I never told my wife I couldn't read. And she wanted me to help the kids with their homework. And I couldn't. I couldn't help her with her homework, so I would make a disturbance and get her all mad, and I'd go down to the bar and I'd drink some more. And I get into community college, and my daughter's helping me with my homework so I can get my high school diploma. I worked in a factory, and that same factory, they were going to fire me. They couldn't get rid of me. I was there 17 years, and then they closed the plant down, and that's the only way they could get rid of me. And I used to say in the podium, I'll never be on welfare, or, and don't say never because it's a long, long time. And I ended up on welfare in 2 years, couldn't get a job. And I got a job at the VA. A friend of mine said, well, you're a veteran, go talk to the VA. And I went to the VA, and I said that, I really said to him, that shit's not going to work going as a congressman. He said, well, then don't go to the VA, don't do it, I don't care. And I thought about it, and so I did it. And I got a job as a janitor, part-time, and then through some circumstances, I ended up being a nursing assistant, a nursing aide. And, you know, there's lots of wonderful angels out there, even though they don't drink. And I got my talking books, and I learned how to be a nursing aide. And my daughter helped me with my homework again. And I passed, and then I felt very guilty about how I did what I did, because I've been very sneaky. I get people to help me, and they don't even know they're helping me. And the hardest thing in Alcoholics Anonymous, I think, for most people in Alcoholics Anonymous, is to ask people for help. And then after you ask for the help, accepting it. Anyhow, I was supposed to write a progress note on some of the clients, and so back to my daughter again, and she's writing out longhand, and I'm sneaking to the back room and got the chart, and I'm writing a note in there about the client, and the LPN catches me. What are you doing? And I said, oh, I'm supposed to write a progress note, and I can't read or write, and you can't read or write. What are you doing here? I mean, that's what she was thinking. And she said, oh, she said, Max, she said, you don't have to do that. She said, I'll write the thanks. I'll write the note, and I'll sign the name. You can sign your name. And so that stumbling block was finished. And then I was feeling guilty because I was feeling dishonest about how I tricked the training instructors into letting me pass and get this job. And I went to them and I said to them, I said, well, you know, I got talking books and da da da, da and to pass this course, but I really can't read or write. And they said, Mac, we got lots of people who can read or write, but we don't have anybody who wants to do the work. So you just do the work and we'll write the notes. And I swear to you that God, and I used to hate him. I used to cuss him out. Why did you give me such a lousy father and such a lousy life? And I had five brothers and sisters, and I thought he was doing a job on me. He was doing a job on me. He was getting me ready for this. 44 years of love and service. I can't do it anymore. I have to sit down. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Mac. For the last time, my name is Cole DiMatteo, and I am an alcoholic. Thank you so much for being here, for listening, for taking the time to come to Special Needs. I mean, this isn't a glamorous thing, you know, and yet you came in. Is it glamorous? All right, we're glamorous. We'll be glamorous.